Sustain 267.
Welcome to the Sustain 267 podcast, where we host conversations on climate change and environment in Botswana and the rest of Africa. I am your host, Patikili Sidze. This is the sixth episode of an eight-part series of conversations that we'll be sharing with you from the 2021 Global South Women's Forum on Sustainable Development, which was hosted by the International Women's Rights Action Watch Asia Pacific, a feminist organization committed to the full realization of women's human rights through the pursuit of equality. This episode's conversation is on strengthening social inclusion in policy and financing processes to secure feminist and just climate transition, and was organized by the Akinamama wa Afrika organization. The climate crisis severely threatens vulnerable communities, livelihoods, access to food, water, and shelter. It exacerbates existing inequalities caused by differences in gender, socioeconomic class, race, ethnicity, and age, and undermines development. Despite this, these communities, which also have the fewest resources to adapt or mitigate its effects, have drawn from their lived experiences to take countless inventive steps to slow it down and address its impacts. Yet, they are often not involved in policy and decision-making. The global decision-making process needs to shift more to inclusivity and center the voices, knowledge, and skills of communities, particularly women in the global south, and leverage on their locally shaped climate solutions for inclusive and just climate transition. The session is moderated by Anne Holland from Sister Sister Foundation in Zambia. She's in conversation with Raya Famau from Lamu Women's Alliance in Kenya, Juliet Nangamba from the Community Technology Development Trust in Zambia, and Stella Agara from Akinamama wa Afrika in Kenya. I shall now hand over to Anne to introduce the session and her guests.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. This session has been organized under the auspices of Amplifying Voices for Just Climate Action Program. Climate Action Program is being implemented by a consortium led by the Worldwide Fund for Nature, Netherlands, and other partners including South South North, Akinamama wa Afrika, Slum Dwellers International, Foundation Avina, and HIVOS under the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs 5-year strategy plan, Power of Voices. The program aims to ensure that by 2025, local civil society and underrepresented groups will have taken on a central role as creators, facilitators, and advocates of innovative climate solutions. Their inclusion is crucial for effective and lasting climate responses. And because of the climate crisis, is also a society challenge with ethical and human rights aspects. The overall approach of the program is to work with civil society to build wide society support for local-shaped climate change solutions through an inclusive and rights-based approach. This includes building a broad-based climate alliance of country-level, bridging divides, urban, rural, gender, youth, that amplifies voices in new and unusual ways. Akinamama wa Afrika brings to the consortium a recognized track record of feminist leadership development, feminist research and advocacy, and movement building to advance women's rights and gender equality for climate change transition. All right, so to start with today, our panel has three amazing advocates when it comes to climate change. Juliet, could you please come on? Could you please just introduce yourself for us? Tell us a bit about what you do, where you're from, the work that you've done, and basically just how amazing you are and how you're trying to change the world when it comes to climate change.
How amazing I am. Yeah, so I think my name is Juliet Nangamba. I'm based in Zambia. I work with Community Technology Development Trust, CTDT in short. I work as the programs manager and I'm engaged a lot in other works around food and seed systems. Yeah, so I think the mandate for CTDT really is to ensure that communities, marginalized communities in the rural areas are meeting their food and nutrition security as well as their seed and nutrition security. So to support this work, and we work with a lot of women because women are the, you know, they're the key custodians of seed, and they're the ones that are nurturing and ensuring they're feeding their households. So to really support this work, we've been involved in the conservation of biodiversity, ensuring that the local seed, the traditional seed or indigenous seed is being supported and is being sustainably utilized to address food and nutrition security in rural households. So among the things that we have done is we have constructed community seed banks in the communities that we work in, and we have empowered women actually to be advocate for these seed systems and food systems that help them, that are ensuring that their children are not going to bed hungry every day. So we use the Farmer Food Schools approach to empower women so that they can engage with policymakers and are involved in ensuring that they are part of the decision making process in terms of food and nutrition security. So gender advocacy is part of our strategies that we use to ensure that we're meeting our intended interventions.
Juliet, I would like us, with your discussion, I'd like to first start with, when it comes to the history of how Indigenous women have been sidelined when it comes to farming, right? When you look at Africa, the majority of farmers, and the reason why we eat mostly is because of women. Women are the largest workforce when it comes to the agricultural industry. And yet, consistently, they're sidelined, they're not added in the conversation, they're not, their complete expertise is always sidelined. They're never really added to the table when it comes to creating solutions on how to feed countries, communities, and basically the continent. And as Zambians, like mostly when you look at our history, right? Even just as an African form of history, you'd find that in the very beginning, African women were the actual farmers. Where African women used to farm, while African men were the ones that would either go to war or they were the hunters, and while the African women were the farmers, right? And so because African women have been farming for centuries, they understand the land better, they understand the climate better, and they have basically created their own forms of farming, and they know how to preserve seeds. They know the perfect seeds to grow in which climate, in which environment. And yet, when we see the industrialization of the creations of seeds and trying to adapt when it comes to climate change, African women are not added to the conversation. They are not given the same opportunities, and they're basically sidelined as being seen as primitive. What do you think of this? Like, how do you feel this has greatly affected not only the climate, but basically how we as a society move towards feeding our ever-growing populations?
Yeah. I think you've said actually the right things. I think to transition and to move forward as Africa, we actually need to put women at the center of the transition process, and, you know, to mitigate and adapt to climate changes. For the past many years, before the 1960s, women farmers, obviously, and they've mastered the art. They were the ones that have selected the crops that we're seeing now, and they're the ones that have contributed to the development of all these crops that we grow. And they've played a bigger role in making sure that the crops that we see now are domesticated. And, you know, this in turn gave women ownership you know, of the crops and as well as sovereignty of the choices, to make choices of what kind of food that they're going to grow, also looking at the climate, what was suited for a particular climate. But this process over time has changed a lot. This process has been actually captured by a few individuals or maybe institutions, which takes the ownership of seed, which takes ownership of land, you know, ownership of resources, including water, and places them in the hands of the few people. I think in the 1960s, we're all aware of the Green Revolution process, which kind of industrialized agricultural, you know, production system. And then we saw that a lot of things like seed, you know, herbicides, fertilizers became a commodity important for producing food, which was not the case before. This has actually placed a huge burden on women who are, you know, the key, who are the center of making sure that we are making progress. The impacts have been really bad on this because we're seeing that there's been a displacement of biodiversity. You know, not the knowledge is eroding, indigenous and traditional knowledge is eroding, and also the colonial system now, the capture of system now, places more emphasis or more importance on the frameworks that are developed now, and sidelines the framework that, you know, the knowledge, the indigenous knowledge that have been produced over time by the majority of farmers, and then they're saying, okay, this knowledge is not important. What is important is what we're doing now. But, you know, this doesn't help us in, you know, mitigating or adapting to climate change, because the crop improvement, the crops that the seed that the women, the farmers have been working with, are bred in such a way that they're adapting with the changes in the climate. But now, because there's a capture, we see a failure of communities to even build their own resistance, to ensure that they're building the resistance towards the climate impact. Yeah.
When it comes to the seeds that are mostly created, the ones with the GMOs, and basically how they have no regard for the environment because they need constant pesticides, and already that messes up the already fragile environment that we live in. How do you feel? Already we know that when these mass crops are created and the mass pesticides are used, it clearly affects the environment, but how does it socially affect the indigenous women who are consistently sidelined, whose seeds are not even put into consideration? How does it affect them socially, economically, even politically? How are they consistently being affected in the community, and how can we help them as a society, as climate change feminists? What is it that we can do that is different, that is not being done? And how can we radicalize this entire system to ensure that Indigenous women are at the forefront of farming in Africa?
So I think because of the new ways of farming, the monopoly way of doing things, you find that a lot of incomes is not going to women. They're not accessing income because you've taken away, you know, the resource that they would have used to access the income. You find that their families, children are going hungry. They cannot participate in anything. They cannot, you know, they are not properly fed. They are not meeting the required nutrition. Hence, it's very difficult to even participate in any, you know, economic process, any social process, any developmental process, because, you know, nutrition and food and seed are key to ensure that livelihoods are being sustained. Without food, you are not sustaining livelihood. Without nutrition, you are not sustaining people's livelihoods. You are taking away the life of people to, you know, to be engaged in any form of, you know, any form of life living forms. What can we do differently? I'm happy that you've asked that question. I think we need to re-strategize. I think the first point of entry for us would be to empower the women who are in the communities. We need to build a mass movement of powerful women that can speak, that can stand and stand for their rights, because they're the ones that are understanding the difficulties that they're going through in the communities that they're in. They're the ones that are understanding the complex system of when the seed is taken away from them, when the land is taken away from them, when the land is not properly cared for, when the water is contaminated because people are supporting use of herbicides, use of pesticides that leads to land contamination. They are the ones that understand, you know, the ecosystem, the functions of the ecosystems. When we empower these women who already have the knowledge, then we'll find the answers that we are looking for. We need to engage more of the policy processes, ensuring that we're tracking that each and every policy that addresses food and nutrition security, that is addressing climate change, is placing women at the center. Women as number one, because they are connected to the ecosystem, they are connected to the land, they are connected to the water, they are connected to the earth. So to overcome the climate crisis, women need to be placed at the center. We also need to ensure that in as much as we are empowering the women to stand up for their rights, we need to ensure that they are also accessing financing. Because if then women are not properly financed, then most of the things that we would want to do will never be, you know, they can't materialize. You know, this world we're living in now, it's like without financing, you cannot really do anything. So we need to empower the women with the knowledge. We need to empower the women to access finance as well.
Thank you so much, Juliet. And I think you've raised a very important point. We as a society like to talk about how we want to empower women, but how can you empower women without providing them financial security and stability and basically funding their works? People will not be just empowered with words. They need actual resources. And I hope, starting from this conversation, we can move towards funding more Indigenous farmers and pushing for their work. Thank you so much. I'll get back to you. For now, let me move towards Stella. Could you please give us a brief introduction about yourself and your amazing work?
So thank you very much, Anne. My name is Stella Agara. I'm the Economic Justice and Climate Action Lead at Akinamama wa Africa. I also happen to be an ardent tax justice advocate, having engaged in tax justice campaigns nationally in Kenya, in the sub-Saharan region, and also globally. And I am proud to announce here that I've also earned an award for my work in tax justice and promotion of youth-led development, and ensuring that women and young people have a chance to contribute to the conversations on taxes, the conversations on economic development, as well as the conversations on their futures and the governance of the continent of Africa. So I think in a nutshell, that's who I am. And currently working with Akinamama and leading the economic justice and climate action work that we are doing.
All right, thank you so much. I'd like to just dive straight into it, right? A lot of your work focuses around ensuring that young African climate change activists receive the funding that they need. As Juliet ended off, she spoke about how we must fund Indigenous farmers and provide them with enough resources to ensure that they do their work. Can you tell us a bit about your work in ensuring young African voices funded when it comes to climate change? Because we've seen it, and when we look at the global scale, we get to see young Western climate change activists funded, provided with the necessary resources, and yet we have very few, if not one or four or five, very few African feminists who are visible, who are given the same platforms and who are also given the same amount of funding as Western climate change activists. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
So indeed, financing is a big factor, and ensuring that the resources are put in the right hands to fund the right solutions is a big factor. And you would be aware that most of the climate solutions that have been implemented so far, majority of them were geared towards benefiting a sector of our society that is already privileged. The focus of a lot of those fundings is in supporting corporates to survive and have some level of resilience to the climate situation that we find ourselves in. The focus is in ensuring that governments look like they're doing something about climate justice. But in the end, the most vulnerable people, the people who suffer the most from the effects of climate change, do not actually get to have their issues addressed. This matter of climate justice is extremely interconnected to the matter of economic justice, because when you deny women and youth access to the opportunities to get resources to do business, to get resources to sustain their livelihoods, you're basically saying they will not even have a say in their own lives. And I think Juliet actually highlighted that. So one of the things that that we must, as a people, begin thinking about is ways in which we shall provide alternatives to the existing models of addressing climate justice, the existing models of addressing economic justice. And the first thing is to ensure that we are looking at these matters as being very interconnected. Economic justice and climate justice are very, very interconnected. The factors of trade being affected by climate justice, indeed, are factors of trade that actually contribute the most to economies around the world. And so that is something that first needs to be considered. What are some of the things that could be done to strengthen social inclusion in policy and financing processes, and especially in promoting or securing feminist and just climate transitions? I think one of the things that must be done urgently is the idea of communicating this message that women, youth, people with disability, gender expansive groups have a special experience of the economic injustices and the climate injustices that take place in the world, and that we cannot continue being lied to, that the solutions being offered at a macro level are actually addressing the problems that these groups face at the grassroots level. So communicating or advancing feminist agendas is a critical part of this conversation. We need to speak truth to power. We need to tell them that we have noticed the direction where the resources are going, and that we know they're not benefiting women, they're not benefiting young people, they're not benefiting people with disability, they're not benefiting the groups of people who are highly, highly affected by the problems of climate justice. We should also boldly speak to transnationals who come in with a lot of resources that they use to manipulate our governments and eventually be allowed to do anything that they want in our environments, including destroying the natural resources. Sometimes in cases such as Zambia, we have had, and even Kenya, we've had situations where they hive out, fence out natural resources so that the communities no longer have access to a natural resource that was originally theirs. So speaking truth to them, only then shall we have a society where when those businesses come in, they also get to speak to the women who fetch water from those water resources that they manage to fence, speak to the communities that benefit from the forest that they manage to begin to deplete when they come into our countries, and have a similar conversation about every other sector of investment, including the extractive sector, where we've seen situations like in the Niger Delta, where women until today are giving birth to children who will continue to be poisoned because nobody bothered to consult them or check the facts about how or the effects that kind of oil spillage would have on them. The second thing that needs to happen is that we need to mobilize solidarity action. So this is amongst the women, and not just the women, but the women, the youth, people with disability, gender expansive people. We need to recognize that these people have a special struggle, and their solidarity will benefit them more than them working in the silos of themselves. Gender justice covers all of these groups and their interests in the economy, their interests in climate justice. And we need to start having that conversation that we highlight some of those issues. Number three, we need to build knowledge. And you'd be aware that some of the conversations that we're having on climate justice, on economic justice, are quite complex, are held at a very high level. Sometimes the figures that we talk about in terms of financing are quite huge. And so when you come to the community and you're telling them about several billion USD, they are wondering whether that amount of money actually exists in this world, because they have never touched it in their hands. How do we start breaking down that conversation so that the women understand that when you say financing for water resource management to the tune of 16 billion USD, they know that 16 billion is equivalent to this number of taps. It's equivalent to this number of wells, it's equivalent to this number of boreholes. That way, they begin to internalize the big figures. Because one of the mistakes that is happening is that the elite in this conversation are happy to keep the conversation that high so that they don't get the pushback from women, from youth, from people with disability. And we must commit ourselves to bring that conversation down to that level. The other thing that we must do is to break down some of the issues that have brought us here. We must break down and make and enable our constituency to understand neocolonialism. We must break it down and enable them to understand colonialism and the impact it had on our economic development, the impact it still has in the negotiations on our climate justice right now, and especially the kind of manipulation that is already ongoing, even concerning climate justice, that certain jurisdictions in this world, in the global south, are experiencing the biggest brunt of climate justice. But we have people who can irresponsibly deny the climate change situation, yet they know too well that there's something happening. So making sure that then we target conversations to break down and expose and demystify corporate power, demystify the extractivism that is ongoing through corporate power, demystify neocolonialism, and demystify all the other systems, oppressive systems that have been set up by capitalists to continue to oppress women, youth, and people with disability. Further to this, I think there's need for us to contribute to knowledge, and that would mean investing heavily in research. Part of our campaigns in demanding for better investment in research requires that we demand for more resources to build knowledge that can be consumed comfortably by women, knowledge that women can be packaged in ways that they will reach women in the rural areas, but they do not have to go and start searching in a website to find a report about, you know, the climate situation in their environment, but knowledge that can actually be able to use to even begin developing resilient solutions to their problems. But for me, the biggest part of this conversation that I'm extremely passionate about is tapping into indigenous knowledge, tapping into local knowledge. We, especially as a continent of Africa, have had solutions that have helped us to manage forest resources.
There's a request that you just speak slowly so that the interpreters can easily interpret your words.
I saw the message in the chat room. It's actually one of the weaknesses that I have. I speak very fast, and I should have given the warning when I started. But I was saying one of the issues in terms of building knowledge that I'm extremely, extremely passionate about is tapping into local knowledge to solve the problems that are arising currently on climate change. Tapping into indigenous knowledge to manage the climate change situation. And you would know that in Africa, for example, we have had solutions offered by the communities living in our continent that would manage the natural resources, ensure that the water table is protected, ensure that there's not too much destruction of forests. And these rules have worked for us for a very long time until industrialization happened. We did not manage industrialization in a manner that accommodates indigenous knowledge. We did not manage it in a manner that accommodates local knowledge. And now we are beginning to lose a lot of critical information that is useful for controlling the agenda of managing or of climate justice and controlling the agenda of economic justice. We have managed to deplete some of the useful trees that we are using to develop medication, and we continue to waste spaces. We continue to destroy forests and build cement cities, even having noticed what effect it has had in the developed world as far as those actions are concerned. That is something we must really take care of if we are talking about managing our rains and ensuring that we have consistent flow of water in our environment. Then we must ensure that then we start thinking critically about this, but tap into the knowledge. And this knowledge mostly was vested on women and was transferred to young people, mostly young women. So we need to tap into those resources and ensure that then we empower those resources to continue to advise our governments on how to manage resources. The last thing is to create and amplify alternatives to the current models of development. This is something that we cannot continue wishing about. We must start having conversations with women where we envision feminist economies. We envision what would happen in an environment where feminist climate solutions are proposed, and work with them in developing ways in which they can start implementing those feminist solutions in their own small ways so that we can demonstrate that these solutions can actually work. Number two, sharing feminist knowledge and practices and agendas. Once we notice that they are working, we document those best practices and share them broadly so that then we can begin to say, these are the solutions that are working for this community. And we think if you continue working on this, you're going to empower other communities to begin living more resilient lives, to begin ensuring that we reduce the impact of climate change and reduce the carbon dumping into the atmosphere. We also need to plan for thinking for new ideas. Get the professionals to start helping us think through new ideas. Akina Mama Africa is doing, always hosts platforms called the Rethink Platforms, which are learning platforms for professionals, for people, subject matter experts, to come and start thinking and proposing different solutions. Because it's very difficult for women to be given the mainstream platforms to speak about these things, we are creating platforms where we amplify their voices as they propose solutions, as they speak truth to power, as they challenge the status quo, as they try to actually provide solutions that are going to address the needs of women, people with disability, youth, and other disadvantaged groups in the society, including minorities whose knowledge sometimes is ignored and is extremely critical. Within these conversations, we must commit ourselves to challenge the economic growth models and to fight inequalities in the solutions that are actually offered by our governments currently. And then, of course, we must commit ourselves to promote a solidarity economy, an economy that does not just feed the rich, an economy that actually feeds the poor, ensures that the poor have a level of dignity in the life they lead, ensure that they are buffered from the effects of climate justice that they did not play such a big role in contributing to and now are having to bear the biggest brunt of, ensure that those voices are on the table when you're having conversations about what to do about climate justice and what to do about economic justice. I think I'll stop there, Annie.
All right, thank you. Thank you so much, Stella. Before you leave, I just have one question, right? I would like to understand, what is it with the West when creating all these solutions and basically during the fight of climate continue to sideline Black African voices? Is it that they because they feel they know better than us? Or I would like to backtrack to the podcast that Akina Mama is going to play. In it, they interview Ruth Nyambura, and she says something very important where she's like, people have to understand that when it comes to colonialism, not only did it come to kill the indigenous way of living, but it almost came to erase indigenous people. So do you feel it's the same thing going on where they are erasing African people? They do not want our solutions on the table because they do not envision a world where we exist anymore? Or is it complete disregard of human life and thinking there's only one way of you know, one way of living, and that is the Western way, and that African lives do not necessarily matter. Because it's really confusing. It doesn't make any sense to me because we're the most affected by climate change. So what do you think is the reasoning behind it?
And I'm so glad you have asked me that question because that's now normally the crux of my presentation on this matter. And for me, understanding the answer to that question that you're asking will then enable us to prepare soldiers for this war that we are actually having to fight on climate change. I'll tell you what it is first. Number one, it's greed, pure greed, that we have people who believe that everything, every decision made must send resources in their directions, must secure privilege for them, must secure a good life for them, and it doesn't matter who gets hurt in the process of them getting that kind of lifestyle. Number two, and this greed was the driver for colonialism. It was the main driver for colonialism because they came and came to Africa to scramble and partition this continent for their benefit. Every railway they built was a railway to transfer resources from wherever those resources were to a water body where they could transfer it and ship it to their continents. Any action that was taken to even get slaves out of this continent was to transfer manpower to go and build their own economies. Today, I'm certain you have seen that they don't even acknowledge some of the work that was put in by women and men that they picked from this continent who worked and paid to build what they call their developed economies. If we were to speak truth, they shouldn't even be as entitled as they are to the kind of benefits that they've gotten out of colonialism. That kind of entitlement has continued to be proliferated in the current state of governance that we have in our continent, that we claim to be promoting democracy, we claim to have independent countries, we claim to have countries that are running functioning democracies and therefore can hold their elections, can choose their own leadership, are free to have aspirations for themselves. But then because of the place they left us at economically, we still have to depend on them. The person you depend on, the person you depend on is the one who decides how you live your life. Okay? You have to dance to the music that the Pied Piper is providing. And for this reason, even when our governments are trying to offer solutions, they still impose their ways. They still impose their ways. They still speak our governments out of prioritizing some of the most important things. For example, animals, to give an example, when the Trump administration was in power, do you think any government in Africa would have proposed to them anything concerning climate justice? Of course not, because the president was a climate denier. And yet he was engaging in development of serious trade agreements with Kenya, serious trade agreements with Tanzania, for example. In this region alone, those two countries had to work on certain areas blindly because they were not allowed to assert the climate situation that was happening in the continent. So they continue with colonialism through the financing, and now it only comes in the form of conditionalities. And I think my colleague Faith is going to be speaking about some of those conditionalities that even come with the International Monetary Fund, with the World Bank, and those international financial institutions that come in claiming to provide aid, but the solutions they offer are actually solutions that then benefit the transnationals, the multinational corporations, and then a little benefit the corporates in the country who have continued to marginalize women, people with disability, and the youth of this continent. I don't think it is lack of knowledge in the continent, and I want everyone in this meeting not to walk out of this place thinking that the Global South is not allowed to participate in the climate justice conversation because they don't know what needs to be done. We know. Before this continent was destroyed, it was being managed by people who probably did not go through the mainstream education system, did not have a PhD, did not have a master's degree, did not write any paper anywhere, but they successfully transferred indigenous knowledge that managed to keep our forests vibrant, managed to keep our water resources clean, managed to keep our water resources fully supplied with water, had ways of training people to ensure that they manage the environment in such a way that rain is kept consistent. And we did not have the kind of carbon emission we have in our society. So now we must courageously begin challenging the oppression that is coming with capitalism and imperialism. We can no longer be a part of the rat race that has become industrialization, that is in a hurry to destroy everything just to give a few resources to a small group of people who then start dreaming of foolish things like going to space and going to I don't know where to go and live there. They have destroyed this space and now they're beginning to try and create an alternative space. We must all stay in this space. We have destroyed it. We must rebuild together. And as we rebuild, we cannot afford to use their knowledge anymore. We must use alternative knowledge. We must use feminist knowledge to be able to propose solutions that will benefit everyone, not just the rich. But the last thing I will say, we also must ensure that we address the consumptionism that they have had us engaging in. It is in the dumping in the food industry in the US that we are able to contribute the amount of carbon emissions that we contribute to the environment. We are now being brought to a place where we also have started that kind of consumptionism, that we have fast food shops that keep dumping food every day. We cannot afford to have that kind of a thing in Africa, because we have droughts in some places. People are sleeping hungry. So we must also challenge ourselves on the consumptionism, live differently, choose to be that different person that we want to be, and then start speaking truth to them, even as they bring their corporations. And part of that will be holding our governments accountable to do what we have agreed is the best solution for our continent.
Thank you so much, Stella. That was a very insightful session. Faith, do you have anything you'd like to share or say, or would you like to play the podcast session now?
So this is a podcast that we, that Akina Mama or Africa recorded together with one of the feminists on the African continent, who also calls herself an ecofeminist. And she basically shares, it's a conversation that's happening between two feminists, and the ecofeminist Ruth Nyambura is basically sharing her insights on the climate crisis. So we've just picked out a small section that we thought we could play during this session. To just help you understand from an African perspective how we view the climate crisis and how we think the climate crisis needs to be addressed. Yeah, enjoy.
Insight into the climate crisis as it stands currently and an African case that comes to mind.
All right, so one of the things when we talk about, I'm always conflicted when I'm asked that question, because when you, if you Google climate change or the climate crisis in Africa, it sort of follows the same old, you know, poverty porn trajectory of people dying, people starving and whatnot.
All right. Thank you very much. I'll hand over to you, Anne.
Thank you, Faith. I hope you can share the link of that podcast so that everyone else can listen to it. Ruth is an amazing climate change activist, and she shares really valid and important points that I feel like we can all learn from as we continue with our work. I'm good. Could you please just give us a brief introduction about yourself and the work that you do?
Okay, thank you all. Good morning. My name is Raya Famau Ahmed. I'm an environmental activist from Lamu, which is in Kenya, and also a member of Save Lamu and Lamu Women Alliance. I'm the executive director of Lamu Women Alliance, and this is a consortium of women-led grassroots organization here in Lamu.
I'd like you first to kind of give us a brief history about your group and your organizing, about how basically how you and your group started and where, how far you've gone with your work.
Okay, first, let me say this. I want to tell the audience that Lamu is the World Heritage Site. Where I'm sitting, I think each one of you can see the sea. This is the most prestigious, serene environment that at least here in Lamu we still enjoy. So Lamu is a World Heritage Site. And there are many things that our forefathers have been preserving for centuries. The language, the religion, the culture, the environment, how we build our boats, how we build our houses, and everything. Then historically, Lamu has been marginalized. Governments come and go, and there's no single development in Lamu until recently, where our government decided that they want to do two major projects. One of them is LAPSET. I think all of you know about LAPSET. This is a transport and infrastructural project which has six components. They're saying they want to build a standard gauge railway in Lamu, which will connect Lamu and Southern Sudan, Lamu and Ethiopia, Lamu and other areas. They're also saying they want to build 32 small ports in Lamu, 32 berths in Lamu. They also want to build 3 international airports in Lamu. They want also to build oil and pipeline in Lamu. They are also right now tarmacking the national highway, which will connect Lamu and other areas. So LAPSET is a big project which our government embarked to do it on 2012. But you see, governments are government when they want to implement big projects. And we as Lamu people, we were very happy because historically we've been marginalized. As we are speaking here in Lamu, there are areas where you cannot access because the road is not good. They don't have good schools. They don't have good roads. They don't have good hospitals. So because our government want to implement this project, we were very happy as people of Lamu. At least this would be the first project that they want to implement. But they started it wrongly. How? They just went into the land and they grabbed the land and chased the local people away. So our organization, which is a consortium of Save Lamu, and Save Lamu is an umbrella organization, we as environmental activists, we did not agree on this. And we went to the district commissioner at that time and we asked, what is happening? People are crying. We are told that there are tractors and bulldozers destroying people's houses, their homestead, their chickens, their animals and everything. Then the representative of the government told us, that's when they told us that, okay, we have earmarked that place that we want to implement the LAPSET project. Then we were like, why are you doing this to the people? Because these are people, these are not animals. You need to give information. You have to tell them what you want to do. And if you want to take the land, you cannot take it forcefully. You have to relocate the people respectively and give them alternative source. Okay, I'm taking this land, then I will give you this place to go and live again. Or maybe you give them compensation, monetary compensation. So you see, because government don't hear the community concerns, they decided to go on with the project. So we as organization, the grassroots organization, decided that I think it's time we petitioned the government to stop this. So we went and we petitioned the government. So for 6 years, we were in court and we got a very good ruling because we won against the government. Why we won? Because collectively as community, collectively as environmental activists, collectively as CBOs, which are implementing environmental activities, we came together to lobby and we formed, I can say, 4 working groups. 1 community working group. This one, we were working with the grassroots people doing mobilization. Then we engaged the legal people, where if we go to court, they can help us with lawyers. If you want to write petitions or we want legal advice, if you want them to do a research. So this is the second cadre of people that we involved. The third one was the communication people. We engaged people so that they can help us amplify what was happening in Lamu. We wanted people to know what is happening. We wanted people to know how our government is doing a lot of bad things here. So the communication strategy really helped us because a lot of people came on board and showed interest to help us. The last one was the advocacy group. This is whereby we held public petitions, telling the people to write online petitions, to do research and say, if you have to do this big project, then you have to follow all the guidelines. Like, you have to do an EIA, tell us how much land you want to take there, then tell us what are the effects of you doing this project here in Lamu, and being a World Heritage Site, how are we going to be affected? How are you going to mitigate all this? Then there was the issue of the fisher folk. Dear friends, here in Lamu, 80% of people depend on the sea to live. It is the major economic activity of Lamu people. And when they are saying that they want to build 32 baths, it means they're going to dislocate the people who are doing their daily economic activity from the area. And then we were wondering what will happen to the community. So we went to court for 6 years, and the court ruled on our favor. It said that the people should be given compensation because the land was taken forcefully. Then there was the component of information sharing, that they have to share information. Then there was the component of social corporate responsibility, the fact that the project is being implemented in Lamu. The people who are not farmers, the people who are not fisher folk, how will they benefit? And our government agreed to give us 1,000 scholarships. They said we give them names of our children, they take them to colleges and university and prepare them so that when the port is ready, they will go back and being employed there. And the last one was the fisher folk compensation. This one is still ongoing because the government refused to give compensation. And up to now, we are in court and we are really struggling for them to get the compensation. Then while we are in court, another project came on top of this. This was the coal power plant project. And we were like, no, 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 this one we will not allow, because everybody in the world is phasing out from coal power plants. Then you hear Kenya government want to implement a coal power plant project in Lamu, which is a World Heritage Site. And the process that they wanted to use, they were telling us that they will export the coal from South Africa. Then they take it to Lamu, they burn it, and then they will dump all the harmful materials into the sea. And see, we as Lamu people see the sea as the heart of Lamu people, the paradise of Lamu people. So because of this, we started again engaging the government. We did one-on-one advocacy. We went to the grassroots and tell the people, okay, we as Lamu people, we want development, but sustainable development. We cannot allow you guys to sit and stay silent and leave our government to come and implement a project where by the end of the day, it is going to kill all the people, all the generation of Lamu people. So we petitioned, we wrote petitions, we went to the TVs, we went to the radios, we did a lot of demonstrations, but the government was not still listening. And we decided again, now we are going to the Environment Court, Tribunal. So we petitioned again the government, and I was one of the petitioners, and involvement of women was very crucial. Because there's a very strong relationship between environment and women. Women are the custodian of this environment. They are the caretakers. They're everything. Women are nature. Even the earth is called, it has a she name. So we said we as women, we cannot stay silent and let corporate come and destroy the environment. Because when you destroy the environment, you destroy women. They will be displaced, there will be lack of crop production, and all the effects of environmental degradation affects directly the women. So we said, no, we will go to court. we told the judges that please don't allow this project to come. If it is a must that you have to implement because the project would cost 200 billion Kenya shillings, then we told them we want sustainable project. Don't bring project. Don't sacrifice your people in course of doing development. You get profit and you kill your own people. So if it is a must that you have to do a project in Lamu, then look for an alternative source of project and do. Like if you want to generate electricity, it is not a must to use coal because everyone is phasing out from coal. And there's a lot of environmental degradation when you use coal. So we told them, why don't you use the sea? As you can see, we have a pristine sea. Maybe you can use the sun and implement a solar panel project. You can use the wind to implement a wind project. You, if you have money, you can even do a nuclear project. But with coal, that one will not allow. So we brought a lot of experts from other people, that expert from the sea, expert from air, people who are experts for the land issues. They came, they testified. The court case went on for 3 years. And we thank God that we as community won again. And the license, as we were all doing this, our government went ahead and issued the license, telling the company that just go on, just leave the riots alone. They're just shouting for nothing. So when we won the case, the license was cancelled. And they were told that they have to do another EIA, and they have also to involve the people because it is enshrined in our constitution, the component of public participation. You cannot go in a place and do what you want. So I think that's what I can share with you.
Raya, like your work is amazing. I'm honestly floored. Everything you've said, honestly, literally brought tears to my eyes. I am so happy that you and your team worked so hard to organize and fight the government and fight these corporations. Because what people don't understand, and mostly, is that our governments are extremely greedy in the sense that when they say they are bringing development, they are actually just pocketing money for themselves. Because we've seen it with different governments from around the world. I'll give an example of Zambia, right? In Zambia, we have I think it's the largest man-made lake in Zambia, which is Lake Kariba. It was created in the 50s. And when it was made, what had happened was that they didn't consult the locals. The locals literally refused because they lived in the... the locals refused. And what the locals told them was that you guys can't touch this land. This is our very holy land. This is where we pray to our gods. This is where we farmed. But they didn't listen. They went and created the dam. And sure enough, it does produce hydroelectricity for the rest of the country. And yet when you go in that area, which is Siavonga, you'd find people were chased away from their homes and they live in hills with homes that are constantly breaking. There's no development. These people have no jobs. They have the same schools they've had for over 50 years. People are suffering. And even as you move away from the town and go into the village, you'd find people don't even have proper access to water. People have salt water because they took away their fresh water, right? And from my understanding, I hear you actually witnessed what happened in South Africa with the coal mines.
Yes.
Can you just tell us a bit about that?
Okay. So when we heard that our government want to implement the coal power plant, because we have friends in South Africa, there's a group called Ground Earth, which invited us to go and witness the destruction of coal mines and coal power plant. They were telling us, you guys don't allow your government to implement this project because it has caused a lot of suffering to the people of South Africa. So a delegation of 8 people from Lamu, I being one of them, we traveled to Johannesburg in a place called Mpumalanga. And we went there and witnessed ourselves the destruction of coal mines and coal power plants. Their water resources was polluted. It was extremely hot in that area because of the climate change. There was a lot of land pollution. Even their animals, they were eating grass that had chemicals because the land mine, the coal mines and the coal power plants were dumping their waste into the land. So the experience was not good at all. And there's also these lies that the corporate companies come and tell you, you know, that you will get cheaper electricity. We are going to build good schools here. We are going to build hospitals. And these are all lies because when we went to South Africa, there was none. Actually, there were houses and schools nearby the coal mines, and all of them were broken down because of the combustion and the force that comes from burning the coal. So we came back and we went to the grassroots areas and we told our people that this is not a good project. Our government should not continue. We called the politicians and we told them, please stop this project. But they refused. We traveled to Zimbabwe. We went to Zimbabwe. I had a privilege to go to Germany because Germany has one of the largest coal mining industry. And I'm really surprised at this time having a coal mine in Germany. So what I witnessed there wasn't good. So we did a lot of advocacy, one-on-one, even to Cote d'Ivoire, because African Development Bank was the bank that was to give loan to the companies. So we went there ourselves and we told them, please don't give our government this money. Give them to give an alternative project, but not coal. So God is great and God is with the people. And I want to tell all my dear people that unity is strength. If you come together as women, as community, you can fight anything. But if you fight alone, you cannot fight the government. So because of all these advocacies, we got very fruitful results, I can say.
I'm genuinely inspired by your hard work, and I hope, like all of us watching today, can honestly learn and continue to push in our own communities. Because you're right, if we work together as a community, if we come together as women and fight and be at the forefront of these movements, we create amazing change like you guys have done. Honestly, I applaud you and I wish you guys the very best. I hope you keep giving them hell and you don't let those politicians get their money. And honestly, at this point, what you guys need are your own representatives in your communities to represent you in parliament, on the on these boards, so that to ensure that the next time someone tries to bring development into Lamu, it's sustainable development that's actually helping people.
I think we can take any questions.
Okay.
Or comments from the audience. I see a lot of opinions being shared in the chat. Could be nice to hear someone.
Okay, so I'm just going to read a few here. Chimwe says, Raya, inspiring collective action, solidarity, and collective effort is key to environmental justice. Which is so true, honestly. Like Raya said, you can't achieve anything on your own. Stella says, I love it, Raya. The emphasis that our predecessors have been preserving how the natural resources are managed. And that's so true because we ourselves have worked hard as Indigenous people. Our ancestors literally worked hard to ensure that our communities are kept safe. And yet this very capitalist and greedy, our greedy representatives literally have no care. Someone else also says, women leaders are powerhouses, Raya leading the necessary action to save Lamu. Honestly, it's extremely inspiring. I am inspired at this point. I feel like I also want to go and join whichever group in my community is trying to fight this form of mass destruction on the land and just do what Raya and her community did. But there's so much solidarity coming on. Thank you so much to everyone that participated. The panelists, thank you so much. I don't know if you guys have any last words to say. I'll start with Juliet, then Stella can go on and Raya can end.
Thank you so much for the lovely and insightful conversations that we have just had. But maybe I really want to echo what Stella was talking about. And I think this is something that Raya was saying in her discussion, that, you know, there's so much we need to actually bring in light the indigenous knowledge that we already have. Because, you know, this is what saved communities in the past. This is what they used, the places, the communities were not distracted, but we're seeing all this destruction because of the new knowledge that is being there, or what we're terming as development. And we have really shunned away from what was existing, what we knew, what protected the earth, what protected the land, you know, what ensured that people had food, what ensured that people had adequate seeds to plant. And this is the indigenous knowledge. We really need to bring that into light. In as much as we're going to go into research, either scientific research, we need to co-create knowledge. We need to bring the scientific knowledge and the indigenous knowledge in one space. I think that gap really needs to be tackled.
That's actually so true. It's really true. Thank you so much, Juliet. Thank you so much for joining us. Stella, could you please share a few last words?
And for me, my closing remarks would be summarized in the words knowledge, agency, urgency, solidarity, and noise. That we need to gather as much knowledge as possible, share that knowledge with the people who need it. Had Raya's team not had information, it should not have been easy for them to engage in the kind of litigation that engaged in and challenged the government and the corporates in Lamu not to interfere with the heritage site. And so knowledge gathering is extremely important. Agency, organizing, ensuring that we use all kinds of platforms to build movements for solidarity work in support of the agenda of feminist economies and feminist climate action. Agency, where the first was agency, where we're talking about agencies and organizations, and agency, where we're talking about speed. There's no time to waste. There's trouble coming if we don't do anything. For those of us who have read the IPCC report, you do know that the crisis is getting bigger. And so we need to ensure that then there's urgency in the actions that we take, that we act fast, that we are ahead of the corporates, and that we try as much as possible to plan before they do. Solidarity, ensuring that we work together, we collaborate. I like the idea of solidarity even across borders, to ensure that then we are learning from each other's initiatives, we are supporting each other, and if it means making noise throughout the continent of Africa and the global south about some of the oppressions that we are having, then let's do it. Let it be so loud that the corporates have no option but to listen. And finally, noise. If we shut our mouths, we shall live with our troubles. If we shut our mouths, we shall continue to be oppressed. So we must make sufficient noise about everything we know. The little you know, make sure that you use every single outlet to communicate it and demand for action. And that way, we shall be able to get certain change for ourselves and strengthen this, social inclusion in policy and financing processes in the global south. Having said that, I really appreciate the good conversations that you have had from my fellow speakers and everyone else who has had a chance to make a contribution in the chat room. That has made for very rich conversations, and this day will be archived as one of those days when we change the trajectory of economic financing for climate justice and feminist economics in the coming future. Thank you, Anne, for the good job of hosting us as well.
Thank you so much, Stella, and you are so right. It reminds me of that quote that says, speak up even if your voice shakes, you know, or they'll accuse you and say you enjoyed the oppression. Raya, could you please finish off and with like a few words?
Maybe let me take this opportunity to thank AMWA and all the stakeholders who have made this fruitful activity, bringing women on board to share their experiences and how we can foster our way together. One thing that I can say, we have to stand for one another. We as women not need to keep quiet and let our government destroy the environment, because we are the environment. So we have to help one another. And you can't say that, oh, this is Kenya, I can't help. This is Uganda, I can't help. This is Malaysia. Women are women. Environment is environment. All the children are ours. So we have to stand together strong, united, and together. Thank you all.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much to all the speakers. Thank you so much to Amwa and everyone who's participated. Honestly, I don't know about you, but I feel so educated in this moment. I prefer being in spaces where Black African women get to speak, because I've always said, if you want to learn, listen to a Black African woman and she will tell you everything you need to learn. Whereas if you hear a man speak, he will repeat everything you just taught him. So I am honestly amazed, and I am extremely grateful for being given this chance to listen to your amazing women. And I hope we continue to shake the world and create impactful change.
Thank you so much to Anne and her guests, Raya, Juliet, and Stella, for the insightful conversation. The link to the podcast episode from Nyamishana's podcast, mentioned by Stella Agara, will be in the episode notes. It was a very rich and informative conversation, and I recommend you listen to it. This is the sixth of an 8-part series from the 2021 Global South Women's Forum on Sustainable Development, hosted by the International Women's Rights Action Watch Asia Pacific. These sessions are available with visuals on the eRaw YouTube page. The link is in the episode notes. Thank you for taking time to listen to the Strengthening Social Inclusion in Policy and Financial Processes to Secure Feminist and Just Climate Transition episode on Sustain 267 podcast. Let's connect on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter on our handle at Sustain 267 podcast and share your thoughts and comments and perhaps your key takeaways from this episode. The artwork for this episode was designed and illustrated by Lulu Kitololo, inspired by the conversation. Find her social media handles and website in the episode notes. I am the host of Sustain 267 podcast, Badugili Sitse, and the sound engineer is Maleho Makoti. Please subscribe wherever you listen to this podcast to listen to more conversations on climate change and environment through African voices. Take care.
Sustain 267.